Welcome to That Was Radio, where we explore all aspects of the golden age of radio, not just the radio programs themselves, but also the personalities and events that shaped those programs. I'm Leon Smothers for WMKY, Morehead State Public Radio. On this episode, we're going to talk about women in radio. During the golden age, there was what I call gender apartheid in radio. As Luther Sees says in his introduction to the Encyclopedia of Women in Radio, everyone understood there was a place for women in radio, as long as they stayed in their place. And this generally meant that in the 1930s through the 1950s, the place for women was daytime programming. For most of our program, we'll talk about the roles women played in primetime broadcasts. But first, I think it's important to discuss the broader scale of women's involvement in radio, because there were times when women were more than welcome in all aspects of broadcasting. Before the 1920s, radio was a scientific novelty. The public was fascinated with the idea of sending and receiving messages through the air. However, in order to participate in wireless activities, most people had to buy a kit and build their own equipment. This was during a time when society saw science as the natural purview of men and boys, while women were naturally suited for music, culture, and the arts. In spite of these cultural norms, many women were interested in science and found ways to learn about radio and how to build and operate their own equipment. Many of them worked with fathers, brothers, or husbands to develop their skill. A number of women worked in the Signal Corps during World War I and developed skills there. Still others worked in factories that designed and manufactured radio equipment and learned about radio in a professional capacity. Most of the first radio stations were operated as a public service by radio manufacturers and large department stores. Since there was no income from these stations, companies used their employees, men and women, to perform all station duties, including operating, maintaining, and arranging for entertainment. These stations operated a few nights a week, and only for a couple of hours. Entertainment consisted mostly of employees singing and talking. If the employees were not particularly talented, they recruited family or friends who were. An example of this occurred at WJZ in Newark. When the station's announcer, Tommy Cowan, needed someone, he would call on a popular local entertainer, Vaughn DeLeith, who became one of the first stars in the earliest days of radio. She had remarkable endurance and could play the banjo, ukulele, guitar, and piano. She would perform for hours at a time. She claimed to have created the vocal style of crooning, as it registered better on early radio sets than did the high soprano voice in which she was trained. DeLeith was also, for a short time, one of the first women executives in radio, serving as manager and chief operator of New York City station WTD. Here is a clip from her 1925 recording, Ukulele Lady, which was also used in the movie Cider House Rules.
Honolulu Bay. There's something tender in the moonlight on Honolulu Bay. And all the beaches are full of peaches who bring their youth along. And in the glimmer of the moonlight, they love to sing this song. If you like a ukulele lady, ukulele lady like you. If you like to linger where it's shady, ukulele lady linger too. If you kiss a ukulele lady, why you promise ever to be true. And she see another ukulele lady fool around with you. Maybe she'll sigh, maybe she'll cry, the tricky wicky wacky woo. If you like a ukulele lady, ukulele lady like a you.
As the number of listeners grew, the stations needed more and better entertainment. Soon the position of program director was formed. These early program directors were usually women. In most localities, women ran the music schools or were piano teachers and voice coaches. These women were talented themselves, but they also knew the talented performers in the area. In the early 1920s, interest in radio exploded. The number of commercial radio stations went from 1 in November of 1920 to 500 by the end of 1923. And by 1925, there were radios in 5 million homes. Over this same short span, the amount and diversity of programming being broadcast by local stations also grew enormously. In addition to music, radio provided coverage of news and sports. In areas with colleges or universities, men and women professors were recruited to give lectures that were useful and entertaining. Civic groups also provided men and women speakers on various topics related to politics and current events. And there were programs on interior decorating, child rearing, and cooking. So by the mid-1920s, nearly every city had women involved in radio as performers, announcers, and lecturers. In many areas, women were program directors, and in a few, there were women station managers. Before talking about how all this changed, we need to step back and look at the debate that was taking place about the role of women in society in general. You're listening to That Was Radio on WMKY 90.3 FM. I'm Leon Smothers. During the 1920s, more women were attending college and holding jobs than ever before. And quite a few young women were challenging the traditional view of women's role in society. They wore shorter skirts and short hair. Their choice for music and dancing was considered to be vulgar by some. Many smoked and drank. Remember, liquor sales were illegal at this time. Some wanted to retain their maiden names after marriage. Others wanted to drive automobiles. And by the late 20s, women were entering new fields, becoming judges, police officers, scientists, engineers, and construction workers. As often happens when societal norms are threatened, there was a backlash from traditionalists. These women were going too far, they said. If a woman was single, then having a job might be necessary. But they felt married women should stay at home to cook, clean, and tend to the children. And women who did work should stick to the jobs for which they were suited, teacher, nurse, or telephone operator. So it's not surprising that the role of women in radio came under attack. In 1924, Charles Popineau, the station manager of WJZ, now in New York, strongly criticized women announcers in a national magazine interview. He said women did not have the skill for the job and that listeners preferred to hear men. Women were too enthusiastic and sounded patronizing on the air. Other influential voices made similar attacks. One was W.W. Rogers of the Westinghouse Corporation, who said that women's voices were either flat or shrill and didn't have a distinct personality. Also, he said, women didn't have a sense of humor when in front of a mic. Even though there were published accounts in other places that women were not only accepted as announcers, but had large and enthusiastic followings, by the end of the 1920s, women had been removed from all places of responsibility and primetime exposure at most radio stations. Many of these women were moved to jobs as secretaries or studio hostesses. A few of the luckier and more talented were hired as executives by the networks. Women would regain these roles again in World War II, but only for the duration of the war. So, after about 1930, women's place on radio was during daytime hours where women were the primary audience. About this time, daytime radio moved away from being mostly educational and to a new form of program, daytime serials or soap operas, as they are more generally known. But as I said at the beginning, the rest of this program is going to be about the roles women were able to play in prime time on network radio. The primary venues for women in prime time were drama, variety shows, and especially comedy. We will feature women in comedy and variety programs another time. For now, we're going to examine only drama, and I'm going to restrict the discussion to those programs that ran for at least 2 years. This will avoid summer replacements and series that died soon after they began. Of all the dramatic program formats in old-time radio, only crime dramas and suspense thrillers afforded women leading roles in primetime. Women were primarily involved in crime dramas in one of three ways: as the wife of a detective, as the secretary or assistant to a detective, and rarely, as a detective herself. Anyone who has seen the popular movie series The Thin Man knows one of the most famous detective wives, Nora Charles. She was the constant companion to her detective husband Nick on all of his cases, generally against his will and often to his dismay. The Thin Man was on radio for 7 years over a 9-year period beginning in 1941 and was carried at some point during this span by each of the four major networks. Claudia Morgan played Nora for this entire period. The series was patterned after the movies, including lots of banter, plentiful cocktails, reformed criminals, some sexually suggestive overtones, and, of course, a mystery to be solved. Asta, their dog, who served as comic relief in the movies, was usually absent in the radio program. Also, unlike the movies, on radio, Nora was routinely an equal partner in crime investigations. Sometimes, she even went on her own into potentially dangerous situations to gather clues or otherwise assist in the investigation. In more than a few cases, though, she managed to get herself into danger and had to be rescued by Nick. In the following clip, Nora and Sheriff Ebenezer Williams are being held at gunpoint.
All right. Get him up, both of you. I'm getting out of here. If any of you try to follow me, you'll be killed. Goodbye.
Hello!
Nicky!
I just clipped her lightly on the chin, darling.
Guess what? Eb solved the whole thing. She's the killer.
Well, of course, baby. I knew it all along.
Now, how did you figure it out?
Darling, you know I never discuss such things outside our bedroom. Wait till tonight.
Why can't you ever tell me how brilliant you are in broad daylight? All right, dear. I'm ready and waiting. Be your story.
Well, it was simplicity itself, baby. I knew that whoever drugged you probably committed the murder. There were only two suspects, Martin and Joan.
And since Martin was dead, it had to be Joan.
Right. I was afraid for a while that Joan was dead, too. I'd have to investigate Gonzalez. Joan confessed that she did it for her husband's insurance. Martin was in love with her, and so was a willing accomplice.
Did you miss me last night, dear?
Well, not at all.
You big liar. Eb, tell me what you said. I ought to stay away more often. It'll make you appreciate me.
Better not try it, or I'll stay away nights, too.
What about me did you miss most of all, Mickey?
The way you say goodnight.
Oh. Well, then. Good night, Mickey, darling.
Noted radio historian Jim Harmon called Claudia Morgan one of the most beautiful actresses on radio, and she certainly had a sexy voice, as could be heard at the end of most episodes when, with the mystery solved, the couple turned in for the night. This is Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY 90.3 FM. You're listening to A Salute to the Women of Radio's Golden Age on That Was Radio. Another detective's wife was Pamela North on the radio program Mr. and Mrs. North. Prior to appearing on radio, Jerry and Pam North had been featured in a series of novels by Richard and Frances Lockridge. In these stories, the Norths lived in New York, were wealthy and sophisticated, drank a lot, loved parties, and solved mysteries. In short, they were strikingly similar to Nick and Nora Charles, except the Norths had cats rather than a dog. The Norths made their debut on radio in December 1942 and were on the air for the next 12 years on NBC and CBS. Jerry was the owner of a publishing company and Pam a housewife, just a normal couple who happened to cross a dead body or two in every episode. In this crime couple, Pam's abilities were at least equal to her husband's, as is displayed in this clip where Pam and Jerry are on a case at a jazz club involving some very groovy cats.
It looks like he's been poisoned.
Eddie, my Eddie. Okay, which one of you did it? I've got a gun in this bag that's ready for him.
Mona, wait. You'll only get yourself in trouble.
Listen to what the guy says, Mona.
Unless you don't care if you shoot, Mona.
I care, all right. I want to get the guy that did it.
Mona, you're awful sure it was one of us.
That's what I was thinking, Mr. Farrell. Mona, you were certainly anxious before to keep us away from Eddie.
You're onto it, Pam. How about it, Mona?
If anybody tries to hang Eddie's murder on me, they'll go right along with him. I loved him.
Now, Mona, don't point that gimmick at me.
Listen to reason, Mona.
I'm listening. Somebody talk.
Pam, I've got an idea.
No tricks now, Mr. North.
What is it, Jerry?
Eddie told me he was going to kill Loopy because Loopy knew he was a convict. And we all know Loopy was in love with Mona.
You mean I killed him? You're offbeat, mister.
Not much. You killed him to get a free hand with Mona.
Okay, Loopy. This looks like the last chorus for you.
Jerry, wait. That doesn't make sense.
Now you're in the groove, Mrs. North.
Oh, but it does make sense. Good sense. Sure, Loopy killed him. He hated Eddie.
Don't you move, Farrell. Don't any of you forget this gun.
I'm not forgetting it. But you listen, Mona. You yourself told us that Farrell didn't know that Eddie was an escaped convict.
That's right.
What are you getting at, Pam?
Well, Loopy didn't have to murder Eddie to get him out of the way. He knew Eddie was an escaped convict, and so all he had to do was report him to the police. But Flash, you didn't know that. And so to get Mona away from him, you thought you had to kill him.
That's a lie.
Farrell, you're going after Eddie.
Don't shoot Mona. Grab him, Loopy. I got him. Me too.
Nice going, Mrs. North. You sure got the power.
Oh, just call me Choo-Choo.
For all but the last 2 years of the program's run, Pam was played by Alice Frost. Frost was an original member of Orson Welles' Mercury Theater and appeared in many other radio roles. The daughter of a minister, she frequently encountered missionaries as a child and learned many dialects from them. From this, she developed a knack for mimicry and was called by her friends the Girl of 100 Voices. The primary means by which women were involved in crime dramas was not as a wife, but as a secretary or companion to a male detective. One of the first and most famous of these was Margot Lane, whose role was explained at the beginning of every episode of The Shadow.
Your local Blue Coal dealer presents The Shadow. These half-hour dramatizations are designed to forcibly demonstrate to old and young alike that crime does not pay. The Shadow, mysterious character who aids those in distress and helps the forces of law and order, is in reality Lamont Cranston, wealthy young man about town. Cranston's friend and companion, The lovely Margot Lane is the only person who knows to whom the unseen voice belongs. The only one who knows the true identity of that master of other people's minds, the Shadow.
The Shadow as radio crime fighter began in 1937 and ran for 17 years on the Mutual Broadcasting System. Over the years, the relationship between Margot and Lamont varied from being cordial friends to Margot becoming the co-lead and intimate partner. There were 8 different Margots, but the first, and I think the best, was Agnes Moorehead. Moorehead, who was widely acclaimed as one of the best female actors in radio, had the role for 2 years before moving to the West Coast as another member of the Mercury Theater. 1943 saw the debut of a couple of programs featuring women as crime fighters. The first of these programs was Nick Carter, Master Detective, which featured Patsy Bowen as Nick's assistant. Nick Carter's exploits are some of the first and certainly most numerous in detective fiction. Since the first story in 1886, Carter has appeared in more than 500 novels and even more short stories, as well as comics and radio. Unlike many of radio's detective duos, Nick and Patsy were just good friends, not lovers. Lon Clark, who played Nick Carter for the show's entire run, summed up the relationship saying, "They were a devoted team, doing what they could to catch crooks." Compared to many other companions, Patsy was less apt to be captured or otherwise become a victim. There was even one episode where Nick was entirely absent and Patsy solved the mystery all by herself. Here's a clip of Patsy in action. To set the scene, Nick, Patsy, and Sergeant Maddie Matheson are about to view a carnival act along with a pompous politician and his prudish wife in order to catch a murderer.
Pull the curtains, Patsy.
Right.
Oh, good heavens! Of all the disgraceful...
Quiet, please, Mrs. Nigel. Wait a minute, Miss Cassell. Stay in the center of the stage. Don't try to talk to Hall. I said don't... What did she say to you, Hall?
I just told him to play a little faster, that's all.
Are you sure you didn't tell him how you murdered the woman we found in the bathtub?
What? Me murder Rosita?
Yes, you.
You're crazy. I wasn't even here. I was in the city.
Oh, no, you weren't. You were right here in town.
What?
Your name may be Roxanne, but you've been working for Hall under the name of Rosita. But it was the real Rosita who was murdered.
You don't know what you're talking about.
How about it, Hall? Is this the girl who worked for you or not?
No, this ain't the one.
I think she is.
And now look, Nick, if Harry says she ain't the one, how are you going to prove different? Nobody else ever saw that dancer without her veil but him.
Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Carter. Prove I was the one who was working for Hall.
All right, I will. Your costume's a dead giveaway.
What a...
The suntan pattern on your back, it fits the cut of your costume perfectly.
Come again?
Standing out in the sun every afternoon doing the ballyhoo on your show, Hall, Roxanne got a tan that fits the lines of the costume she wore. The same costume she's wearing now. But the girl in the bathtub wasn't tanned that way. The pattern of her suntan didn't fit the costume. The dead girl never worked for you, Hall.
Okay, you're right, Carter. No use trying to bluff any longer.
No, you fool! I told you while I was dancing I'd split with you if you'd stick with me. I was giving you a chance to...
Given him the same treatment you gave Rosita, the first chance you got.
I've got a treatment for all of you if you try to stop me. A lead treatment. Under this veil that's draped over my right hand, I'm holding a gun aimed at Miss Bowen's back.
Can I let her have it, Nick?
Not if you want Miss Bowen to live. She's going to leave with me. And if any of you try to follow her, she gets shot. So if you want me bad enough to have her killed, come right ahead.
Patsy slowly puts her hands up as the dancing girl reveals a new use for a veil. Nick hesitates as the two climb down off the platform. We'll see what happens in just a moment. Now for the conclusion of The Case of the Candidate's Corpse. Today's adventure with Nick Carter, brought to you by new post-war Old Dutch cleanser. With her veil-covered revolver pressed firmly against Patsy's back, the dancing girl moves toward the rear of the tent.
Keep away from me if you want a live secretary, Mr. Carter.
You heard her, so help me.
It's all up to you. If you don't follow me, she'll be all right. Toss me your car keys, Harry.
Now look.
Be quick about it.
Okay.
Now... lift up the side wall of the tent, Miss Bowen.
Lift up the what?
The tent canvas. Lift it up so we can get under the tent.
Oh, okay.
There.
Higher, you dope.
I can't. That's as high as it goes.
All right, hold it steady while I get under it. Don't you... Hey, help me! I've got her, Nick!
You've got me, have you, why, you little son? Oh.
Maddie, hold the canvas up off so I can get a hold of
her. Right, Nick!
Watch out, Patsy, don't let her...
Get
okay,
right,
I've got her.
Hurry, Mr. Carter, before she kills somebody!
All right, Patsy, you can relax. I've got her gun.
Yeah, and I've got her.
That's what you think. Why, I'll...
Oh, no, you won't. Now shut up and behave yourself.
You all right, Patsy?
I guess so. A couple of sore spots, but that's all.
Knocking her over with your foot when she bent down to get under the tent wall was fast thinking, Patsy. Remind me to tell you later what a smart girl you are.
Nick Carter first aired in April of 1943 on Mutual and continued there until September 1955. Charlotte Manson was Patsy for most of this run. She was a versatile and talented actress who was on such diverse programs as the patriotic dramatic series American Women and the melodramatic Shadow of Fu Manchu. July of 43 saw the premiere of the program Casey Crime Photographer, in which Ann Williams is a reporter for a fictional newspaper, The Morning Express. Her co-worker Casey is a noted crime photographer and amateur detective. The pair never seemed to spend time at the office, though. They would generally be found trying to get leads for a story at the Blue Note Cafe, the favorite watering spot for a variety of interesting, if often seedy, characters. At other times, they would head for the offices of the Homicide Division, looking for tips from Captain Logan. Often the pair solved the mystery as much by getting entangled with the criminals as by discovering and following clues. Here's a clip from the program that features Jan Minor as Anne. In this scene, Anne is cruising the highway, searching for a pretty young hitchhiker who has been robbing men when they stop to give her a ride.
On and on, up and down. No road angel here, no road angel there. Only road. And, Casey said he began talking to himself after a few days of this. And I gave him the raspberry. Uh-oh. It's her. It couldn't be anybody else. You're looking for a ride, sister?
No, thanks. I'm waiting for somebody.
A driver wearing pants and a wolfish grin?
Not necessarily.
Oh, sure you are. I know you.
You know me?
Same as one soldier knows another, by the uniform. I used to play the road myself in a tight-fitting dress and clutching a little overnight bag.
Yeah?
I gave it up a couple years ago for a better racket. The road's small-time kid. It's too much risk for too little income. Come on, hop in. Let's get acquainted.
Okay.
Toss your bag in the back on top of my luggage.
Swell-looking suitcases you've got back there?
Yeah, a lot of them. Filled with swell clothes. I do all right. Close the door. Let's get rolling. My name's Annie Johnson. Present, that is. What'll I call you?
Doris will do. Doris Larkin.
What college you out of?
College?
Yeah. I've got graduation papers from Tehachapi myself.
Oh, that's the woman's prison in California.
Are you a reformatory gal?
I was in Elmira for a while.
You're a liar. They don't put kids in there.
I'm over 21.
Save that for guys who are afraid of minor trouble. You're San Quentin Quail, under 18.
You're really pretty smart.
Yeah, with my background, I ought to be.
What's your racket now?
Oh, same as yours, men. But I make them pay thousands while you collect dimes.
I collect more than dimes.
Oh, sure, yeah. You rope a sap for as much as a century now and then. But your average is small. And sometimes you hit a guy who hits back.
No guy hits back at me and gets away with it.
Yeah, I've heard you punks talk big before. I used to do a little bragging myself, as I remember.
Does this look like I'm bragging?
Oh, you lug around that .38?
And I've used it.
Say, I read about you in the papers. A guy named Pierce, maybe, and another named Hotchkiss.
Yeah, I killed him.
Yeah, and the cops are looking for a male hitchhiker to pin those jobs on.
Cops are men, which means they're dumb. I hope they burn some man for those two jobs I did.
You never admit things like that, do you, Doris, except when you're alone with a friend like me?
Oh, I don't figure you for a friend, Annie.
No?
I never had a friend and never expect to have one. My father used to slug me, and even my mother beat me up until I ran away from home. I don't trust anybody. I hate everybody. Now turn into the next side road we come to.
You're gonna take me, huh?
For all you've got. With a prison record like you've got, you're not going to call copper any more than a married man would.
Well, I won't make any squawk, Doris. because I'm not going to be taken.
Oh, let go of my hair.
You give me that gun,
will you? Pull your hair out.
No, I will. I'm not a man, and I don't mind messing you up. Here's Angel's gun, Casey, and you can take the rest of her, Captain.
Here.
These guys.
Surely you remember me, Miss Chapman. And you'll get to know Captain Logan here very well. He's boss of the homicide
bureau. Yeah, and if you'd been as smart as you thought you were, Doris, you'd have noticed that a car was following us. It's followed me for almost 4 days, just waiting for you to take a ride and talk. She said what you hoped she'd say, Casey.
Good.
I didn't say anything. You can't prove I did.
But I can, my pet. Under all those suitcases is a tape recorder that I started when you got into this car. It's taken down your every sweet word.
And I'm pretty sure the bullets that killed Pierce and Hotchkiss will match the rifling of this .38 revolver.
And if that isn't enough evidence, here's one guy you may get out and walk who'll talk loud and long in court.
You dirty rats. You lousy skunks. You
Come,
dirty rats.
Angel.
The role of Anne on Casey Crime Photographer was played on a somewhat revolving door policy. That is, five different women played the part in just over 8 years that the show ran. The two primary women in the role were Jan Miner, who we just heard, and Kathy Lewis. This is Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY 90.3 FM. You're listening to a salute to the women of radio's golden age on That Was Radio. Another woman crime fighter was Claire Brooks. Brooksy, as she was often called, was the assistant to George Valentine, who ran a newspaper ad every week that read,
"Personal notice. Danger's my stock and trade. If the job's too tough for you to handle, you got a job for me, George Valentine. Write full details."
In Let George Do It, Valentine wasn't as hard-boiled a detective as Sam Spade, nor was he just an intellectual like Sherlock Holmes. While he was tough enough to handle most any situation, he solved most cases by using his head, not his hands. Even when he seemed to be stumbling through an investigation, by the end of the episode, he always had the solution. Brooksy was a smart and sassy girl Friday and an almost constant companion as Valentine solved mysteries. When he needed, she would interrogate witnesses, investigate crime scenes, and occasionally run afoul of an armed and dangerous suspect. In the following clip from April 1951, East German communists have been sabotaging shipments of tin from mines in Bolivia, tin that was being used for U.S. military supplies. George and Brooksy are undercover visiting the mine as a news reporter and photographer. As we join them, the two are hiding outside a mine shack and overhear a plot by the Germans.
If the railroad is put out of commission, no tin can be taken out.
Yeah, but we tried that before, and they fixed the railroad.
Ah, but when we have finished this time, they will not fix it for many weeks. Listen to me. The ore train is loaded and ready to leave for Antofagasta.
Yeah, I know.
We have company cars, several of them. They are mountain roads.
What are they saying, George?
At one point, the road comes very close to the railroad line, remember?
Yeah, at Estero Pass.
Yeah. By leaving now with dynamite and the detonator, one can be well ahead of the train when it reaches that point.
Who can we trust to do this?
Ourselves, no others. We must do this ourselves. Who knows, perhaps we will be rewarded by the party.
Yeah, that's good.
Now let us make our preparation.
Come on, Brooks. Okay, George. Well, George, what do we do now?
Take some pictures.
But those men were planning something about wrecking a train, weren't they?
Yeah, sure. But they don't know we know about it. They're going to start off on one of the company autos before our train goes back.
And
as soon as they're out of sight, we're going to take another company car and follow them.
Oh, well, I suppose you know what you're doing.
Just a rough idea, Brooksy, but it might work.
Oh, look, George, they're coming out of that tool shed and heading for the car.
Yeah, I see. I think if I get a shot at the mouth of the mine, it'll be pretty good. Stand over there beside it, will you, Brooksy?
Oh, sure, George. Tell me where you want me.
Well, right there's good. Yeah, that's very good. Hold it there.
Hello, Valentine. Decided to take your pictures anyway, huh?
Oh, yeah. I thought I'd get a few while we're up here.
I'm afraid they will not be very interesting without the workers.
No, that's true, but, we'll come back again for those.
Yeah. You are leaving on the old train, of course.
Oh, sure. When will it be pulling up?
In a very few minutes. I suggest you get aboard.
Yeah, sure, we'll do that, Mr. Schmidt. And, we'll be seeing you. Place, all right, Brooksy. And there's the company car parked up ahead.
Yeah, but where's Mueller?
Oh, down by the track somewhere, I guess. Now, let's get out.
All right.
Easy now.
I don't see them anywhere.
Just take it quiet, like, Angel. Don't make any noise any more than you have to.
Oh, I won't.
Hey, wait a minute. Hey, listen, there comes the train. Yeah, we gotta work fast.
What are we gonna do?
I don't know yet. Just keep your voice down. Hey, duck behind these rocks.
What, did you see something?
I thought I heard something. Over there, by the tracks.
George, I didn't hear anything. Could it be your imagination?
I don't think so, Angel. I don't think so.
You can see a lot of track from here.
Yeah, sure. That's how they picked this place, I guess.
The train's almost here.
No, not quite, Angel. You can hear it a long way in these canyons. It won't be long, though.
George.
Yeah, what?
There they are. They've been hiding behind those rocks, see?
Yeah, sure. But wait a minute. They're nowhere near the tracks. Just waiting back here. I wonder... Yeah, sure.
What, George?
I remember now. They were talking about dynamite and a detonator. They must be all hooked up and ready.
You mean they can set it off from here?
Sure, that's it. Now you stay here, Brooksy.
What are you going to do?
Sneak up as close as I can without attracting their attention and get the drop on them.
George, he's holding the plunger on that box.
I know. Now keep quiet and come when I call you.
Okay.
Stay loose!
All right, get away from that box.
Miller. It's just that
I said,
car.
Get away from that box.
You'll gun Schmidt.
Drop that. That's better. You might reach as high as possible. Come on.
You're making a mistake, Valentine.
Oh, yeah. I'd rather say you almost made a mistake. Brooksy.
Yes, George, I'm coming.
You see, Mr. Valentine, we can explain.
You can explain a lot of things later. Brooksy, Schmidt found it smart to drop his gun, see if Bola has one on him.
All right, George.
But I do not have a gun. I don't carry a gun.
Just dynamite, huh?
No, he doesn't have a gun, George.
Okay, now how fast can you get down that bank onto the tracks?
Well, I'll try it and see. What do I do?
Flag that ore train, Brooksy. When you get them stopped, tell them they got four more passengers. Two of them for a one-way trip.
The series Let George Do It debuted in November 1946 and ran for 12 years. For 11 of those years, it was broadcast by Mutual on the West Coast only. Brooksy was played by several women, but the best remembered are Virginia Gregg and Frances Robinson. Gregg, who was in the clip we just heard, was one of the most versatile and most believable actresses from the golden age of radio. In addition to several thousand appearances on radio and several hundred on television, she was in more than 45 films. To close out the segment on women crime fighters, we'll consider a couple of women who did it on their own. As far back as 1932, the very early days of radio drama, there had been attempts to create a series with a female crime fighter in the lead role. Most of these were either soap operas or juvenile dramas. It wasn't until late 1941 when NBC first aired Hot Copy, that such a program with any staying power made it to prime time. In fact, it was all over prime time. In the 26 months that it ran, NBC aired Hot Copy in 5 different time slots. The program featured a successful, crime-solving reporter named Ann Rogers. Her police contact, Sergeant Flanagan, was dedicated and well-meaning, but had, at the best, mediocre detecting skills. So Rogers would often have to help him through the deductive process. Ann Rogers was solidly in the reporter as sleuth tradition. She asked tough questions and listened closely enough to pick up subtle clues. She was good at spotting lies and contradictions and was perceptive enough to earn the title Miss Sherlock. Since the program aired during World War II, many of the episodes involved spies and saboteurs as well as the usual criminal sorts. Here's a clip from an episode of Hot Copy from February 1944 entitled Death Studies the Angles. Anne is about to confront Pete McNulty, a photographer for a rival newspaper, with the murder of a local politician. McNulty is unaware that Anne has sent her assistant, Sprightly Poole, to get the police.
Well, I guess I better be running along, Anne. I'll see you later.
No, wait, Pete.
Why, Miss Rogers, you astonish me. The two of us, all alone in this big building, at this hour of the night. I didn't know you cared.
Oh, don't be funny, Pete. I
Just wanted to discuss the Barnaby case.
Oh, the Barnaby case. Still on that subject, huh? What about it?
Well, there's lots of things. Like, why should he have been killed? Nicky wouldn't have done it. Barnaby owed him money. Countess wouldn't have done it. He was lavishing gifts on her, so...
And, just what are you driving at?
Driving at? Nothing, just thinking out loud.
Same old Sherlock Rogers, huh? But the funny part of it is, your thinking usually gets results. And, hold that pose a minute, will you?
Why? What are you going to do?
Oh, just getting the old camera out. A whim. I'd like to have a shot at the famous Anne Rogers, feminine intuition, in operation.
No.
What's the matter, Anne?
I said no. Don't point that camera at me.
So. So you know Anne, huh?
No. Please, you're hurting my arm.
You figured that I killed Barnaby. Then you didn't go for my little act about the makeup editor not using my picture, huh?
No, I'm afraid not, Pete. No more than I could go for your explanation as to how a cameraman working for a modest salary could afford to gamble at the Shamrock Club. What was it, Pete? Blackmail?
Yeah, it was blackmail. I had a dozen pictures of Barnaby gambling at the club and with a counter scraped around his shoulders.
Pictures taken in the club? They don't allow cameras in there.
I'm pretty cute with a camera, Ann. I used a vest pocket rig with a plunger in my pants pocket. Swell for candid camera shots.
But why kill him, Pete, if he was paying you blackmail?
He was. But the worm turned tonight. Barnaby told me he was going to have me behind bars. He forced my hand. I had to get rid of him. Just as I'm going to get rid of you, Ann Rogers, with this little gadget in my camera.
It shoots a poison dart.
Oh, yes, Ann. Very tiny. Very deadly. Its puncture looks like a little scratch. Remember? No one will ever suspect. I'm really sorry about this, Anne. I like you.
No. No, Pete.
I can promise you it won't hurt. Come on out, you little wildcat. There's no one here to help you. Stop struggling, you.
Help!
Stop it!
Sonny!
Stop your...
Help!
Stop!
I'm coming!
Come on, boy! Watch out! Watch out! All right, Miss Sherlock. You always get your man, don't you? Congratulations.
Yes, Brightley. He's dead.
Unfortunately, only 4 episodes of Hot Copy are known to exist. However, many of the scripts for the show are in the archives of Marshall University, and much of what is known about the series is based on those. Of the women who played Anne, Betty Lou Gerson, who was featured in the clip we just heard, is best known and had the longest tenure. While Gerson was predominantly active in radio, she is probably best known to modern audiences for her work with Disney Studios, which used her as the narrator in Cinderella and later as the voice of Cruella de Vil in the popular animated feature 101 Dalmatians. You're listening to That Was Radio on WMKY 90.3 FM. I'm Leon Smothers. The final crime drama that we will discuss represents the only truly successful primetime female private investigator. Candy Matson, Yukon 28209, was created in 1949 by Monty Masters and was initially intended to be an action adventure featuring a male detective, with Masters himself playing the lead role. But after his mother-in-law read the draft script, she convinced him to change the gender of his private eye. So, Master's wife, Natalie, ended up in the title role. The show debuted on NBC in June of 1949, featuring a sexy female private investigator with a wry sense of humor. In the following clip from the second episode of the series, Candy introduces herself.
Hello, Yukon 28209. Yes, this is Candy Matson. Hello.
Candy Matson?
Well, I wasn't sure when I looked in the mirror this morning.
Had a rough night, eh?
Oh, there have been rougher ones. Look, Voice, before you get caught with my receiver down, who are you and what do you want?
As to who I am, you'll find out very shortly. What I want is you.
How romantic and over the phone yet.
Let me finish. What I want is you to lay off that cable car business.
Oh, that? Well, I'm afraid I can't. You see, I was sitting beside him when they discovered his transfer had been punched, sort of permanently. That's how things happen with me. I get into the craziest routines. You see, I used to be a model. I've been told I have the proper displacement for such a career. But I found there wasn't enough money in it. A girl has to maintain a nice apartment on Telegraph Hill, keep enough clothes to highlight the displacement I mentioned, and also eat, doesn't she? Sure. So I turned private eye. You meet a better class of people, mostly named Rigger or Mortis.
While Candy was sexy and beautiful, she was also hard-boiled in her own way. She often carried a gun and would use it when necessary. And she didn't back down from anyone. Candy was fearless, if sometimes foolish, going wherever she needed to solve a case and doing whatever she needed to do. There were two primary recurring characters on the program. The first was Candy's love interest, Police Lieutenant Ray Mallard. The other was Candy's best friend and sidekick, Rembrandt Watson, a noted photographer and a man of culture, as well as being an expert on a wide variety of topics. Watson was also perpetually broke and always looking for ways to sponge money from Candy. Candy Matson was produced in the Radio City building in downtown San Francisco, even though by 1949, NBC had transferred most of its Bay Area personnel to Hollywood. Monty Masters wrote most of the scripts, which provided everything a great dramatic program should have. Strong and likable characters, fast-paced excitement, subtle humor, and authentic settings. Every episode included specific and accurate descriptions of San Francisco's streets, landmarks, and geographical sites. Almost every prominent Bay Area feature figured in at least one episode. Area sports figures and celebrities were frequently mentioned, and on occasion, Monty would cast a local personality to appear on the program. The sound effects were authentic and perfectly timed, adding a realistic feel to the program. In addition to the standard effects, the sound men could imitate cable cars, foghorns, buoys, and various other sounds you'd hear in the Bay Area. The storylines, while varied in terms of crime and motive, did have a certain structure its fans enjoyed. Candy usually began the plot line with a contact from a new client. She would then often consult with Mallard, who would criticize her choices. Later, she and Rembrandt would have a brush with some danger, which Candy would resolve. At the conclusion, Mallard would solve the case, but usually only after Candy did so. In the following clip, Candy is working a case involving a film crew shooting on location in San Francisco. She has been reunited with Buff Arnold, an actor she knew during her brief stint in the movies. An actor and the director have been murdered, as we will find out later, by a jealous lover. Candy, following a hunch, is making her way to the director's hotel room.
I let myself into the darkened room, closed the door behind me. And with the lights of the city way below seeping through the balcony window, I found a place in back of the settee and sat down to wait and think. The balcony window being open, the roar of the city traffic underneath came gently through and helped my thinking. And that's when it hit me. Seema. Several years before I had served my term in Hollywood, there was an actress named Vivian Seema. The same face as that of Cherry Dana. Now the clouds were beginning to lift, and at the same time, the door opened in the suite and the silhouetted figure of a man entered the room.
Blast the luck.
Okay, Buff. Relax.
What
the? This is Candy. Come on over here by the settee. Hurry. I'm expecting company.
What are you doing here, Candy?
You've got the wrong page of the script. That's my line. What are you doing here, Buck?
Honestly, you've got to believe me. I left my lighter here this afternoon. I was afraid the police would find it. Naturally, I can't afford any bad publicity. It ruined my career.
I believe you, Buck. You always were fond of that career, weren't you? Don't answer. Just keep quiet.
What's up?
A guy named Seema, if I'm right. Shh. Wait a minute. I hear someone coming along the hall. The door slowly opened and closed again. dim light from the hall showed the form of another man. Then the dark figure moved slowly but surely across the room. It stopped for a second or two, as though listening for something. Then moved again to the balcony, out onto the balcony, and whoever it was grabbed the ledge above, hoisted his feet up onto the iron grillwork, and hung over the city. That's when I acted. Okay, Ames, stay right where you are, in that position.
What? You think I'm a fool?
Candy's out on that ledge. He's ducked around the outside on that ledge.
Oh, the fool. Quick, Buff, go down the hall and get out of the fire escape. Cut him off.
Okay, what are you going to do?
Go out on that ledge after him. You better come back, Ames. You're cut off at both ends.
Oh, no, I'm not. Not with this gun I've got.
That's the same gun you killed Dix with, isn't it? Very clever hiding it up on this ledge out here. No wonder Mallard and his boys didn't find it. Look out there on the city, Ames. One misstep and you go off into space. Think it over. You better come back.
Not on your life.
I'm coming after you.
I'm down at the other end, Candy.
Good. Now we've got him.
Yes. Yes, you have. Obviously, this is the end. Perhaps you don't know what it is to love. Perhaps you don't know what it is to be scorned. I do. Painfully so. This is the end. But I'm not going to go alone. You're going with me, Miss Matson, like this.
No! No, the recoil. It'll knock you right out of the net.
Oh!
Despite being an immediate hit, Candy Matson never found a sponsor, largely because, by this time, many companies were shifting their advertising dollars to television. So by the spring of 1951, the decision was made to terminate the series. The final regular episode of Candy Matson aired on May the 21st, 1951, although there was one episode recorded about a year later in Los Angeles and aired under the title Candy Matson Yukon 38309. Although all 90-some episodes were originally recorded, only 14 episodes of Candy Matson are now in circulation. As a postscript to the discussion of women in crime dramas, I want to acknowledge very briefly a couple of programs from the early 1950s that almost met my inclusion criteria. The first is Time for Love, which featured Marlena Dietrich as an international operative named Dionne LaVolta. Vaguely reminiscent of the movies The Blue Angel and Casablanca, LaVolta traveled to exotic spots around the world, solving mysteries and confronting international criminals. The other is Defense Attorney, starring Mercedes McCambridge as attorney Marty Ellis Bryant, who spends most of her time not in the courtroom, but out on the street solving crime. McCambridge was another remarkably talented actress who had many roles on radio, stage, film, and television. Orson Welles once called her the world's greatest living radio actress. She is known by many horror movie fans as the voice of the demon in The Exorcist. To finish our discussion on dramatic programs, I want to mention briefly the contributions of women in the primetime thriller programs such as Suspense, Escape, and Lights Out. These were anthology series. Each episode was independent, with different performers chosen from week to week as required. Some of the women that we've already discussed were frequently featured in these programs. Kathy Lewis, one of the Anns from Casey Crime Photographer, often starred in suspense episodes such as On a Country Road and A Plain Case of Murder. Virginia Gregg, who was Brooksy on Let George Do It, was also featured on Suspense in Good Night, Mrs. Russell, and others. And of course, any discussion of suspense must include Agnes Moorhead's performance in the episode entitled Sorry, Wrong Number, which critics acclaim as one of the best radio broadcasts ever. The anthology programs were also perfect vehicles for featuring movie actresses, popular singers, and even comedians. For example, Vera Allen starred in an X-1 episode called Hallucination Orbit. Suspense brought in Ava Gardner for an episode entitled Lady in Distress, and Lucille Ball for A Shroud for Sarah. Lights Out featured Dinah Shore and Gloria Blondell in a thriller entitled Valse Triste. In closing this program, I want to emphasize that there were a lot of women whose voices weren't heard on radio, but still made significant impacts. Ora Nichols was a sound effects pioneer, and from the mid-1930s, the head sound engineer for CBS. Ruth Woodman was creator and writer for Death Valley Days, a program that was on radio and television for 4 decades. Kathleen Height was the first woman writer on the CBS Westerns, writing some of the early Gunsmoke episodes and nearly all of Fort Laramie. And there were many more. If you're interested in learning more about women in radio, here are a few books that I recommend. Invisible Stars, A Social History of Women in American Broadcasting by Donna Halper. The Encyclopedia of Women in Radio by Leora and Luther Sees. And, especially because I love the title, Private Eyelashes by Jack French. You've been listening to That Was Radio, where we discuss old-time radio programs and the people and events that shaped them. I hope you've enjoyed this program and will join me again next time. I'm Leon Smothers, and this is Moorhead State Public Radio, WMKY 90.3 FM.